From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
No normal human being would see a film at 8:30, at 11, at 1, wait in line for half an hour for a 3.25-hour Turkish film, and dash off and go to another film.
Maybe not, but our critic at large, John Powers, does it just about every year at the Cannes Film Festival. Today he talks about this year's festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. He'll tell us about the films that were surprisingly good or bad, and the films that won awards, including the top prize, the Palme d'Or, and the slightly less prestigious award,
the Palme de Whiskers, which one of the critics gives every year for the best cat performance.
Also, we listen back to an interview with Maya Angelou. She died today at the age of 86. She was famous for her memoirs, including I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She wrote and delivered the inaugural poem for Bill Clinton in 1993. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Cannes Film Festival, the most important international film festival, concluded this past weekend. Getting an award at Cannes gives a new film the kind of pedigree that helps ensure good international distribution. Fresh Air's critic at large, John Powers, who is also the film critic for Vogue, reported on the festival, as he's done many years. And as we've done several times in the past, we've invited him to tell us about the winners and the films that generated the biggest response, positive and negative. John, welcome back to Fresh Air, and thanks for taking some time to talk with us about Cannes. So let's start with the film that won the top prize. Tell us about it.
The winner of the Palme d'Or is a Turkish film by a director named Nuri Bilge Ceylan, who's well-known internationally, not so well-known in the United States. And his film is a Chekhovian study of a rich, famous actor who thinks himself a very enlightened man. However, he's not so enlightened in dealing with his tenants, who are largely poor and Islamic, nor is he so enlightened in dealing with his wife and his sister, both of whom know him so well they see through him. And the film is basically a portrait of modern Turkey seen through these people who all live in this posh hotel and their dealings with the people around them. It's filled with hilariously penetrating arguments between family members who know one another so well that every line they say to one another has many, many meanings. It's a tad too long at 3 hours and 15 minutes, but it's actually a very good film.
Would you have voted for it for the top prize?
The funny thing is, when I saw it, I wouldn't have. I was tired and jet-lagged and thought, this movie will never end. And yet, as the week went on, it stayed in my head very, very well. And I realized that, in fact, it probably was the best film in the competition.
Do you think it will open in the United States? Will we be able to see it?
I think you will be able to see it. I think, partly because it won at Cannes, partly because Turkey's in the news, very interestingly, and partly because I think what often happens with European or non-American filmmakers is that gradually some sort of critical mass builds up and their films start being seen.
So what was the hottest ticket at Cannes?
Oh, hilariously, the hottest ticket at Cannes was for Ryan Gosling's directorial debut. I mean, it was very funny. I was at a lunch for another movie, a Hollywood movie, and at one point, all the critics left and dashed off because we all had to go see the first feature by Ryan Gosling, which turned out to be not a good film. You realize that Ryan Gosling has seen a lot of movies and liked a lot of them, and so about every minute or two, you could identify some other famous director he was copying. So it started off a bit like Terrence Malick and Harmony Korine. A few minutes later, it turned into David Lynch. And then along the way, it turned into this guy, Nicholas Winding Refn, with whom Gosling has worked a lot. And it was this big, bloody, or fake bloody, apocalyptic, crazy melodrama with bright colors and darkness and bullies and people murdering rats and all sorts of other stuff that would seem powerful if you're putting it together and if you were David Lynch. But in the event, everyone thought was really, really bad. And so the discussion became, was this the worst film a director ever had premiered at Cannes?
Whoa. worst ever. But, you know, it's funny
ever,
because...
But it wasn't.
But you know, I think it was last year that Ryan Gosling was in a film that, as I recall from what you said, was booed. The film Only God Forgives?
Yes. No, it was booed last year. It's a very peculiar thing because Ryan Gosling... And some of the older viewers may not realize this, is a huge international star and much beloved by women, so that he is a sex symbol and a star in the way that Brad Pitt was before Brad Pitt's movies really started being big movies. Ryan Gosling is kind of in those early stages of superstardom. So everything he does is invested with interest. So the longest line I saw at Cannes this year was for his film. The most excited fans were for his film, and the only problem was the film wasn't very good.
Hmm. Too bad. I think he's a great actor. It's a shame.
Oh, no, he's a great actor, and I'm all for him. And in truth, you know, he was trying to make a genuinely great movie. And, you know, I respect that impulse more than somebody cautiously making a small little movie that's perfectly done for their first film.
So let's get to another prize winner at Cannes, and this is the second place, the Grand Jury Prize. It went to an Italian film called The Wonders by a director I have to say I've never heard of, Alice Rohrabacher. Tell us about her and the film.
Well, she is a young Italian director who most people have never heard of. She's only made one feature before that most people didn't see. But going into the festival, she was highly touted to win the Palme. Then the film showed, and people didn't love it enough. and it gradually got ignored along the way, and people were even kind of mean to it. You know, the critic in Variety said it didn't have enough weight to be in the competition at Cannes, which was completely wrong. And then, in the end, it won second prize. It's basically a story, a family story, about a young girl whose parents have more or less dropped out of society, moved from the city to the Italian countryside, where they make money by making honey by taking care of bees. And the film is about her growing up, dealing with her family, but also about the transformation of the Italian countryside, which is becoming more and more about money and less about the old tradition. So it's a political film on the one hand and a personal film on the other. Extremely well made, not perfect, but a very impressive work for a young director in her 30s. And, you know, I was happy to see her get the prize.
Oh, good. So that's another one you think will come to the U.S.?
I think it will come to the U.S. I think one of the nice things when films win big prizes at Cannes is that a film that's good but doesn't sound commercial will suddenly take on a commercial life, and we'll get to see it in the U.S.
So two films tied for third place at Cannes, and that's called the Jury Prize. And one of them was a film that was apparently very divisive. Some people loved it, some people hated it. That one was called Mommy. And the other that tied was a Jean-Luc Godard film called Farewell to Language. You want to start with the one that caused so much disagreement?
Yes, you know, it's quite interesting because the two who tied, the young guy who made the film called Mommy, his name is Xavier Dolan, who's from Quebec, and he's 25 years old, and this is his fifth film. His first film played at Cannes when he was 20, and he's kind of an enfant terrible. And this film certainly lives up to that. It's the story of this over-the-top working-class mom whose son is an even more over-the-top and violent boy. And essentially, it's about their battles against each other, against society, against the social structure. What do you do with people who are completely out of control? It's broad. Some people think it's funny. It's extravagantly big in emotions. And when it played at Cannes, it gave people a jolt of energy that led some people, I think, to think it was better than it actually was. Coming out of it, people either thought it was brilliant or almost unwatchable. That was one of the third place winners. The other one was this extremely arcane but beautiful film by Jean-Luc Godard, the great French master who at 84 is still probably the most radical filmmaker working anywhere. And it was a film about all the things that Godard likes to make movies about, which is to say the impossibility of communicating, the beauty of images, trying to connect to nature, how much fun it is to look at naked people. And what was so fascinating about this film, which I quite liked, was that it may be Godard's final film. And it's interesting that a person often thought to be the most intellectual and difficult filmmaker ever ended his film basically making the hero of this film and his work his dog. Because what he loves about dogs is that they fit into nature, they're neither conscious nor self-conscious, and they're capable of unconditional love. So after all the intellection, after all the brilliance, after all the difficulty, finally Godard is coming out on the side of being a dog.
You know what? You don't have to write dialogue for dogs.
You don't have to write dialogue for dogs because, as we learn from the film, dialogue doesn't really tell the truth. And in addition to all of that, the film is shot in 3D and partly uses 3D to mess with our heads because normally they try to make 3D look great. But Godard, being a radical, actually does certain moments where he superimposes two images, both in 3D, and when the images hit, your eyes start going in different directions and it all blurs and your eyes almost spin in your head. And you learn something about the nature of depth perception and 3D from watching his film because he actually plays with it in a way to show you how our vision works as well as just trying to make depth deeper in the film.
Am I going to get a headache?
If you watched a little longer, you would. But the first time he did it, people were so stunned and delighted that somebody was just messing with them with 3D that the crowd spontaneously broke into applause.
Okay, so I have a confession, John. I stopped going to Godard films years ago. I loved his early work, and then I started to find his film so didactic, and yet I still couldn't even understand what he was trying to say. So is this one good enough so that I should break my record of him not going and actually go?
I don't know that I could go that far. If you've skipped the last 20, I'm not sure that this one is enough different. But, you know, given that it may be his last one, I then think probably people should go just to see what it looks like, when somebody is really pushing against every possible thing that one considers normal in a movie.
Well, I'd find it interesting about his dog, too. I think I'll go.
Yes. No, and his dog is very cute, named Roxy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is our critic at large, John Powers, and he was at the Cannes Film Festival, which wrapped up Saturday night, and he's telling us about some of the films there. Let's take a short break, John, then we'll talk some more about Cannes. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Cannes Film Festival, which wrapped up Saturday night. It's the most important international film festival, and with me is our critic at large, John Powers, who goes to Cannes just about every year, this year being no exception. So let's get to another award at the Cannes Film Festival, and Best Director. That was won by Bennett Miller for his new film Foxcatcher, and see, he also made Capote.
And Moneyball.
Moneyball, and a documentary called The Cruise.
Which is wonderful, which is quite wonderful.
So yes. Tell us about Foxcatcher.
Okay. Foxcatcher is based on a true story that somehow I never knew. It's the story about two Olympic wrestlers who get involved with the heir to the DuPont fortune, John E. DuPont, who decides he's going to set up a wrestling facility to help Olympic wrestlers, but it's partly his own vainglorious attempt to make himself impressive in his own eyes, in the eyes of the world, and in the eyes of his mother. And so you actually watch these more or less working-class wrestling types entering the world of the ultra-rich, and then very bad things happen, as they did happen in real life, where DuPont murders one of the brothers for reasons that even now are not quite clear, although watching the film, you start to understand some of the reasons why.
It was a very big story in the Philadelphia and Delaware area, because that's where, he was from, Delaware.
Well, and in fact, it's such a spectacularly interesting story. The film stars Channing Tatum, who one doesn't think of as being a very good actor, but who is very good here. It stars Mark Ruffalo, who one thinks of as being a good actor, and who's excellent. And Steve Carell, wearing a prosthetic nose, playing the millionaire Johnny DuPont in a kind of creepy way that's unlike anything you've ever seen Steve Carell do before. All three are good. And watching the film, you understood why Bennett Miller won the Best Director, because he controls this complicated story. He never overemphasizes anything. And he gets really good performances from different levels of actors doing different kinds of things, which then reminds you that, you know, his first feature, Capote, won Philip Seymour Hoffman the Oscar, and that Moneyball got both Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill nominated for Oscars. And unlike many American directors, he doesn't hit everything hard. So it's a very subtle story, and he leaves you room to try to figure out yourself what's going on.
So this is the third movie that Bennett Miller has made that's based on a real person. There was Capote, based on Truman Capote, Moneyball, that was based on the general manager of the Oakland A's, and now this one based on John DuPont. When you see a movie like Bennett Miller's movies, do you go to the news stories or to the biography or the book afterwards and see, is this an accurate depiction of what happened, and does it matter?
Yes, I do go, partly because you actually want to know what artistic choices the person made in putting things in and leaving them out. And sometimes it matters. I mean, I think that you know you're seeing something that's based on a true story, so it doesn't claim to be presenting everything exactly as it happened, and partly because there'd be no way of knowing exactly what happened. Even if you were there, there'd be different points of view. But what's interesting is that sometimes when I go back to the original source, I find that a film could have been more interesting. Sometimes you find out something, a way that something has been simplified. If I can give an example from a film that everybody probably did see, in The Social Network, for instance, Mark, the founder of Facebook, in fact, wasn't just a nerd. He belonged to the fencing team. so that for the film, you remove that because you want him to be more nerdy in relation to the brothers, the big athletic rowing brothers. But in knowing that, then you decide, does that make it a richer film or a poorer film? You know, you realize that every film has to chop out some of the information that would be there. In the case of this particular film, I'm still not quite sure. It's a very interesting film. I read some details about the murder that John DuPont committed, and you know, they struck me as being really interesting. But you then realize you might have had to put in two or three scenes extra just to get to those points, at which point the film becomes endless. So you would naturally cut them out.
I just always wonder, why not just make a fiction film inspired by a story and not pretend like you're telling the story if you're not really going to tell the story? And again, I don't mean this film in particular because I don't know how closely it adheres, but I'm always slightly bothered when the fiction version of a story, because it's fictionalized in the movie, replaces the real version because you don't know what's real and what's fake. And so I do wonder, why not just make it up?
You know, I think there's probably weirdly a commercial reason. I mean, you know, the critic Dwight MacDonald many, many years ago wrote an essay called The Society of the Fact, where he talked about how Americans in particular were drawn to stories that were rooted in truth and facts about the real. You know, that in other countries that's less true. And it's certainly the case that more and more Hollywood is drawn to stories that are in one way or another true. You know, there are the extravagant stories that are clearly not true about Spider-Man, for instance, or the X-Men. But a lot of the so-called serious films now out of Hollywood are anchored in true stories, which maybe are thought to give gravitas. It's a way of, you know, that you can bring the people on to publicize the film and talk about the real life events around the film. In my own case, I'm like you. I'm a friend of mine once declared me the most literal minded person he'd ever met, and so I always look at things and think, really, why would you leave that out? But that happened. Or I look at something and think, but you can't say that because now people are always going to think that this was true.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And real life is always so much more complex and nuanced than the movie version. I never thought of it that there was a commercial reason.
Yes, and you're also now competing in this era with reality television, you know, which claims to be real. So I think that probably more and more there's a generation that's being raised, assuming that lots of stories are rooted in reality and it's perfectly normal and everybody knows you fool around with them. Whereas, you know, an older person like me, and I'm not that I'm ancient, mind you, but an older person like me was used to stories that were made up most of the time. Increasingly, you get stories that aren't made up.
The Best Actress Award this year went to Julianne Moore for her performance in a David Cronenberg film called Maps to the Stars. And the film is an adaptation of a Bruce Wagner novel, and I was really surprised to hear this because Bruce Wagner writes usually satirical films based on life in Hollywood, and Cronenberg has been a kind of non-Hollywood guy. He's, well, not only because he's from Canada, but also because his sensibility is really not a Hollywood sensibility.
No, it's not. I mean,
let's just mention some of his films so people know who okay. He is. Like History of Violence, Eastern Promises.
He made the film Dead Ringers and The Fly.
Yes.
And Naked Lunch. You know, he started off making pulpier, visceral horror movies and then gradually moved into more literary enterprises over the years. This particular one is, I guess, a poison pen letter to Hollywood in a way, in that it portrays Hollywood in all of its child-abusing, self-aggrandizing horror. Julianne Moore in this particular film plays a slightly crazy, narcissistic actress who's living in the shadow of her dead movie star mother. And she hires as her assistant a mysterious young woman played by Mia Wasikowska, who may or may not be some sort of avenging angel. And swirling around them is the fake guru therapist played by John Cusack and the handsome limo driver played by Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame. And the film is a portrait of that kind of Hollywood, but told with the kind of coldness and detachment, in a way, that Cronenberg often brings to things. So it's a very weird, very nastily funny film. And Julianne Moore plays, as she often does, an out-of-control person. But she does it hilariously well. Going into the film, I knew she was playing that role. And I thought, good heavens, I don't want to have to see Julianne Moore playing a nutty middle-aged woman. I don't think I can handle it. But in fact,
why not?
She nailed the role. Because she's been doing it for 20 years.
Oh.
And because she's a good actress and is fearless, and because Hollywood, once you do something, they want you to do it over and over again, has been playing some version of the cracking up woman for 20 years. And because the last time I'd seen her was in the film Don John, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt film, where she played a sensible woman, and she was so wonderful, I thought, thank heaven she gets to go back to being just a normal human being rather than a nut job. Here she plays a nut job, but she's so great that I wasn't surprised she won the prize.
John Powers will be back in the second half of the show. He's our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. Here's the Harry Lime theme from The Third Man, the 1949 film starring Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten, which won the Grand Prix when it was shown at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CNN with the new original series, The 60s, The Decade That Changed the World, premieres Thursday night at 9 on CNN. From Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And from Reprise Records, with Neil Young's A Letter Home, an unreleased collection of songs from the past reproduced by Jack White and Neil Young. This is NPR.
Coming up, more about the Cannes Film Festival, and we listen back to our 1986 interview with Maya Angelou. She died today at the age of 86. Her memoirs, beginning with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, describe growing up in the segregated South, working as a singer, actress, and prostitute, becoming active in the civil rights movement, and temporarily relocating to West Africa. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with our critic at large, John Powers, who's telling us about this year's Cannes Film Festival, the most important international film festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. John has reported on the festival many times, for Fresh Air and for Vogue, where he's the film critic. We're talking about some of this year's Cannes Award winners. So Julianne Moore won Best Actress. Best Actor went to Timothy Spall for his role in Mr. Turner, which is about the English painter. Well, is it William Turner or J.M.W. Turner? Because there's two.
J.M.W. Turner, yes. And it's a fascinating film for two reasons. One, because Timothy Spall is really wonderful as Turner. He's a guy who's been playing supporting roles in lots and lots of films, in everything from Mike Leigh films to Harry Potter, because he's physically not altogether prepossessing. I mean, he himself, when he talks about it, says, oh, they've hired an ugly guy as the lead actor. And he gives this role of as this vaguely uncommunicative kind of grunting man who also happens to be a genius. It was kind of a challenging film for Mike Leigh to make because Turner famously had one of the dullest lives of all time. So what you're trying to do is capture the genius of an inarticulate man in a dull life. And the movie actually succeeds splendidly. Somehow you believe that he's doing these beautiful paintings. You see him in his world where he has the housekeeper who's in love with him. You watch him enter the Royal Academy and compete with other painters. And you gradually get a sense of this man's world. So even though Turner himself never does anything particularly interesting, Timothy Spall is so good and the stuff that Mike Leigh puts around him is so interesting that the film is genuinely revealing and very exciting to watch.
So there was another biopic at the festival, too, about Yves Saint Laurent.
Yes, it's the second of the Yves Saint Laurent biopics. There's one that's going to be opening in the U.S. in June.
This isn't the one that I saw the trailer for.
No, this is not the one you saw the trailer for. This is the second one. This is the unofficial one, which is interesting because the official one was allowed to use all of Yves Saint Laurent's clothing and designs. This new one is the unofficial one because it's less friendly. And therefore, the man who controls the Yves Saint Laurent estate wouldn't let them use anything, so they had to invent fake Yves Saint Laurent outfits for all the way through the movie. And insofar as they had to do that, they do a great job. The interesting thing about Yves Saint Laurent is that he's one of those figures who's kind of like Warhol, where when you try to get any kind of purchase on his inner life, it seems almost impossible. So rather like Turner, he's somebody who's almost impossible to penetrate. And in this particular case with Yves Saint Laurent, the question is then, how do you show the world of somebody who is clearly a genius, and Saint Laurent was clearly a genius, and show what he's like when he will almost never reveal himself? And so we watch the people around him doing their work, and that's very interesting. There's one of the most brilliant scenes at the festival, maybe the single most brilliant scene at Cannes, is a scene where a middle-aged woman comes in to be dressed by Saint Laurent, and she's very shy and nervous, and he gradually makes her over, and just with a touch here and there, playing with her hair, and she's completely transformed. And you realize, oh, this is what he could do and why he was worshipped. And actually, even the appeal of fashion is that you can walk in feeling kind of frumpy and not sure of yourself and walk out thinking, boy, I look great and I'm full of power and glory.
Worth seeing?
It is worth seeing. I mean, it's slightly exasperating, but it's filled with really great stuff. I mean, it's fragmented. It is worth seeing. But you know, I wouldn't run there. I might walk.
The Cannes Film Festival is like the most important international film festival. And one of the things that makes it special, I can say this just from reading about it, I've never been there, is that you have films from so many different cultures, representing so many different values and lifestyles. And sometimes some of the people who've made those movies have taken great risk to make the films because they come from authoritarian cultures where film is not smiled on, or film that has what's considered to be subversive values can land you in jail. This year, the Iranian actress who starred in the Iranian film A Separation, Laila Hatami, kissed the president of the Cannes Film Festival at the opening ceremony. Apparently, it's not a sexy kiss, but the kind of kiss you give a colleague at a festival. And this is France, where everybody says hello by kissing on both cheeks, right? So now there's an Iranian student group that's saying this kiss is a sinful act, and this actress, because she kissed a man in public, and this violates Article 638 of the Islamic Criminal Justice Code, and they want her to be flogged as stipulated by the law. What was the reaction to this at the festival?
Oddly enough, there wasn't so much reaction to it. You somehow would have thought there would have been.
I would have thought that.
I can't tell whether it's simply because as we move farther and farther away from 9/11 and the various Middle Eastern wars that slipped out of people's mind, or whether now people just think every time anyone from Iran comes to Cannes, there's always some sort of trouble. You know, so every year there's some filmmaker who has a film there for which they could be imprisoned for making, that it's now become sort of folded into the normalcy of the festival. I mean, but of course it's absurd to think that you would flog someone for that, because this is a perfectly normal piece of behavior. It's also tricky because, you know, you're a bit under a globe when you're there. So many people work such long days. I mean, you know, I leave every morning at 7:30, and I often finish, you know, very late at night, that you almost don't even get a chance to read the papers. And I think I am more attuned to the outer world than many of the people there. So it's possible that just nobody knew much about it. When you're there, you're much more likely to be overwhelmed by celebrities jetting in to promote products. The transformation of the festival is that the parallel festival, which is celebrities and parties, gets bigger and bigger. And the one thing I've noticed over the years is that every year there are fewer film critics at the festival and more people who are sent only to cover parties.
So, John, how would you sum up this year's Cannes Film Festival? Was it a good festival, lots of good films?
It was a festival with lots of good films, but not a lot of great, you know, knock-you-out films. It's one of the peculiarities of the film festival biz, I guess, is that when you fly halfway around the world, you want to be knocked out. And so if a film's merely good, somehow you're disappointed. So that although I probably saw, you know, 10 or 12 films that if in the normal state of my life I'd driven to a screening to see, I would have been delighted that I saw them. Because I was jet-lagged and flown halfway around the world, I then thought, this isn't quite good enough. You know, and what often happens with these films is that I then see them later back in Los Angeles. And I think, boy, was that a good film. And I think, why was I so negative about it when I saw it at Cannes? And the answer was, when you fly to Cannes, you're expecting masterpieces. And so you're disappointed by mere excellence.
And you're also seeing one film after another after another. It's a very unnatural way to see a movie.
Yes, you know, no normal human being would see a film at 8:30, at 11, at 1, wait in line for half an hour for a 3.25-hour Turkish film and dash off and go to another film. And if they did it, they wouldn't expect to think, oh, I'm going to be having a good time at all of these. Whereas when you're at Cannes, you're going there and you think you're being rigorous and critical and intelligent. And what's happening is you're getting exhausted and you're getting tired of being in line. You're getting tired of talking to people the whole time. And you're getting tired of sitting, you know. And in the midst of all of that, you then have people like myself making judgments that they then later think aren't true.
You know, in following your blog posts about the festival, it sounds like there was a lot of movies this year with animals, including Jean-Luc Godard's new film, and also lots of scenes of brutality towards animals. Any pattern that's emerging here?
When you watch animals brutalized on film, I find it almost unbearable. You know, I have ever since I was a boy, and I think probably most people do. I think that one reason why this year and increasingly you're seeing abuse of animals in film is that it's a way of getting pure emotion out of audiences. That it's a way of reaching audiences who are so jaded and have seen so many people murdered on screen that they don't care. But somehow if you actually see a cow shot down or a rabbit or in particular a dog, that plunges a dagger into your heart in a way that so many of the other things don't, because maybe because you've seen them so much or because cinema's gotten so violent toward people, that now you almost don't reach people. A couple of years ago, there was a great boom in films about dead children and missing children. And that's now been replaced by terrible things happening to animals, which is a very depressing and discouraging thing to watch. You know, I mean, for several days in a row, I watched some animal die awfully on screen. You know, so it was a great relief by the time you got to the Jean-Luc Godard film, where he was loving his dog. And the film by Asia Argento, the once scandalous Italian actress who made a film about her childhood where basically her great friend and guardian angel was her cat, Dak, a big, wonderful black cat that won the Palme de Whiskers, which one of the critics gives every year for the best cat performance.
John, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for telling us about Cannes this year.
Well, thank you for having me.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, we listen back to a 1986 interview with writer Maya Angelou. She died today at the age of 86. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. Maya Angelou died today at the age of 86. We're going to listen back to an interview with her. In her 6 memoirs, she explored how race and gender affected her life. Her first memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, was published in 1969 and described growing up in the segregated South. It included the story of how Angelou was raped by her mother's boyfriend. After the rape, she withdrew into herself and went through a long period of not speaking. Maya Angelou got pregnant and became a mother when she was 16 and unmarried. Her autobiographies describe how she traveled around the country with her son Guy, earning her living as a waitress, prostitute, singer, actress, and writer. In the 60s, Angelou was active in the civil rights movement and worked with Martin Luther King as the Northern coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. When she was 33, she moved with her son to West Africa, yearning for the sense of home she'd been unable to find in America. In 1982, she became a professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University. She was the inaugural poet for Bill Clinton when he took office in 1993. In 1986, she told me that she thought her writing style was influenced by Southern African-American preaching and music traditions.
I find in my poetry and prose the rhythms and imagery of the best, I mean, when I'm at my best, of the good Southern black preachers, the lyricism of the spirituals, and the directness of gospel songs, and the mystery of blues, are in my music, or in my poetry and prose, or I missed everything. There's a blues, I was just thinking when I said the mystery of blues, I hadn't thought about that before. But there's a 19th century blues which asks this question. Have you ever had the blues so bad you could feel them in the palm of your hands? Now that's mystery, and that's poetry. And that's what I try for.
Did you grow up going to church a lot and listening
Lord.
To a lot of blues? And
I went to church. My grandmother took me to church on Sunday all day long, every Sunday into the night. Then Monday evening was missionary meeting. Tuesday evening was usher board meeting. Wednesday evening was prayer meeting. Thursday evening was visit the sick. Friday evening was choir practice. I mean, and at all those gatherings we sang. We sang long meter hymns, which are almost lost now, Terry Groves. It's a shocking, sad loss.
What's a long meter hymn?
In a long meter hymn, a singer, they call it, lays out a line, and then the whole church joins in repeating that line, and they form a wall of harmony so tight you can't wedge a pin between it. So that a person would sing, as long as I live and troubles rise, I'll hasten to his throne. Then everybody comes in. If I was there, I would sing, as long as I live, and then there are all these twists and turns and melodic accidents, harmonics, and accidental harmonics which take place, which are just delicious to the ear.
Are there poems that influenced you when you were starting to write or that made you want to write?
Oh, so many. There's a poem called Sympathy of Paul Laurence Dunbar's. Mr. Dunbar wrote this about 1890. The first stanza is, I know what the caged bird feels ah me when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind blows soft through the springing grass, and the river flows like a sheet of glass. When the first bird sings, and the first bud opes, and the faint perfume from its chalice steals, I know what the caged bird feels. Oh, dear. The whole poem is so beautiful. There are three verses to it.
What else really influenced you?
Well, Shakespeare. I was very influenced, still am, by Shakespeare. I couldn't believe that a white man in the 16th century could so know my heart. If he could know my heart, a black woman in the 20th century, single parent, all the things I was heir to, then obviously I could know a Chinese Mandarin's heart and the heart of a young Jewish boy with braces on his teeth in Brooklyn. It meant I could know, if he, over those centuries, could know me so, that he could write, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state and trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed. I'm desiring this man's art, that man's scope, and with what I most enjoy, contented least.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with Maya Angelou. She died today at the age of 86. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Maya Angelou died today at the age of 86. We're listening back to an interview I recorded with her in 1986. Her first memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, dealt in part with being raped when she was a child by her mother's boyfriend.
When you were young, you went through a period of, I think, several years of not speaking.
Yes.
Was it because of the rape?
Yes.
Do you think that you developed a sense of language through all those years of listening and not speaking? I think of the memory that you have, of the facility for language that you have, and of all those years of not speaking, what was happening in
yes.
your mind?
Well, I think I thought of myself as a giant ear. Something out of Gary Larson, which could just absorb all sound. And I would go into a room and just eat up the sound. And I memorized so many poets. I just had sheafs of poetry. Still do. I would listen to the accents. And I still love the way human beings sound. There is no human sound which is unbeautiful to me. And so I'm able to learn languages because I really love the way people talk. And when I was very young, blues singers used to come walking through the South with cigar box guitars, really a cigar box and a piece of wood and catgut strung along it. And they'd come around the store and sing. And the fellows from the Brazos of Texas had a sound which was absolutely Texan. And they'd sing, I'm just running around here, baby, I'm done. Think about you, well, my I'm done. Loving you, baby, well, anything you do. Oh, it's so gorgeous, I could pull my hair out. Then the guys who had come from Mississippi and a portion of Louisiana had another sound. They would sing, babe, please don't go. Babe, please don't go. Babe, please don't go back to New Orleans. They feed your rice and beans. Nowhere you ever seen. Babe, please don't go. And it was way back in the mouth, see? So I would listen, listen. Just fantastic. I still get excited about any human being speaking or singing.
Isn't it amazing how that period of being mute probably, in its own way, helped you become the writer that you are?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How did you start to speak again after you'd stopped?
Well, Mrs. Flowers, a lady in my town, a black lady, had started me to reading when I was about 8. Really reading. I was already reading, but I mean, she started me to reading in the black school, and I read all the books in the black school library. And she had some contact with the white school, and she would bring books to me, and I would just eat them up. And when I was about 11 and a half, she said to me one day, I used to carry a tablet around on which I wrote answers. And she asked me, do you love poetry? So I wrote, yes. It was a silly question for Mrs. Flowers, and she knew I just. She told me, you do not love poetry. You will never love it until you speak it, until it comes across your tongue, through your teeth, over your lips. You will never love poetry. And I ran out of her house. I thought, I'll never go back there again. She was trying to take my friend. She came to the store, and she would catch me and say, you do not love poetry. Not until you speak it. And finally, I did take a book of poetry, and I went under the house and tried to speak, and could.
Did you have to find your own voice after those?
Oh, yes, for years I did. I didn't even know where it was placed, for that matter. And then I didn't trust it. I was afraid of, not said this before, but I was afraid it might leave, you see. Since I had pushed it away so long, it might, on its own, just take off. And then muteness is much like any other addiction. It stands just behind my eyesight, just behind my shoulder, in critical moments when a marriage ended, which I thought would never end. It stands there offering itself to me, saying, I've got something for you. Come to me.
I'm really surprised to hear
it's
that.
It's terrible.
It's tempting to not speak.
Delicious.
I guess hearing that from someone as eloquent as you makes it even harder to understand, because you could use language to any effect. No.
It's so tempting that when I'm really in bad shape, I sing. And my mom and my son will find me wherever I am and stay with me and see me through that period, because it's there, it's saying, come.
Right.
I can make life so simple for you. you'll never have to explain anything again.
When you went to Ghana, you were searching for a home, but you left Ghana after about a year or so and went back to America. And you've lived where you're living now in North Carolina
yes.
for a few years, and you have a permanent position at a university there that, you know, you can keep as long as you want. It's a lifetime professorship. Do you feel like you have your home now? Does that really feel like home, or is part of you still searching for home?
No, I believe North Carolina is my home. I really believe my home is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I know, however, life offers wonderful, and by that I mean full of wonder, chances. I expect to be in Winston-Salem the rest of my life. My books are there, my paintings are there, my friends are there, and my work is there.
Maya Angelou recorded in 1986. She died today, at the age of 86, at her home in Winston-Salem. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Florida Power & Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. Thinkaboutit.org. From Knopf, publisher of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In for Graduates, with advice for entering a competitive job market and six new chapters at leanin.org. And from Esurance, insurance for the modern world, with online tools that provide customers with 24/7 advice and support. Learn more at esurance.com. This is NPR.
For the record, Annie, you flirted with me. You made me feel like you really liked me, which was really unfair.
That's Chris O'Dowd as a police officer in Bridesmaids, the film that made him famous in America. He's now on Broadway, starring with James Franco in Of Mice and Men, and his autobiographical TV series is on Hulu. Chris O'Dowd on the next Fresh Air.